Last week, we finished our study thinking about Moses, who led the people out of Israel and out of slavery in Egypt, and the Israelites' dramatic escape from Pharaoh and the land of Egypt. And there were many amazing things that God did to take them out of the land. And during their journey, there was many miracles, and God took care of them all along the way. Every time they had a need, he supplied that need. Everything that was something that had to happen, he made it happen. The handout I gave you has a little map of the direction that they took, as best as we can tell. But there was little incidents at Kadesh Barnea that we're going to talk about a little later. So the Exodus was a very dramatic story of how the people of Israel and God succeeded in pulling them out of Egypt. Unfortunately, the Exodus is also a story of man's failure, major failure of the children of Israel to follow God's will. And we're going to start with the story of when they spied out the land and what happened and where they went wrong. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. We're going to look at Numbers chapter 13, 25 through chapter 14, 35. This is kind of a long passage, and just bear with me here, but there's a lot of information here that we need. Starting in verse 25, it says, "At the end of 40 days, they returned from spying out the land, and they came to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the people of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them, to all the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told him, 'We came to the land which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey, and its fruit, and this is its fruit. However, the people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of Negeb, the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the hill country, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the Jordan.' But Caleb quieted the crowd before Moses and said, 'Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it.' Then the men who had gone up with him said, 'We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we are.' So they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out, saying, 'The land through which we have gone to spy out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are of great height. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim, and we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them.'" Now, at this point, the people... What would you feel like? You had these great expectations, sent these people into the land, and came back, and you hear these things. You know, we are really hard on them, but think about it. Okay, let's continue. Chapter 14, this is where the people rebel against God. "Then all the congregation raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night. And all the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, 'Would that we had died in the land of Egypt.'" And this is really important, this next phrase here. "Or would that we had died in the wilderness." They're going to get their wish. "Why is the Lord bringing us into the land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And they said to one another, "Let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt." Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before the assembly of the congregation of the people of Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes and said to all the congregation of the people of Israel, "The land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their protection is removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." Then all the congregation said to stone them with stones, but the glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of meeting to all the people of Israel. Now think about this. They're all terrified at this point, and these two, the youngest two of the group, come to them and are trying to plead with them. And then Moses, the person that they depended on all this time, is begging them to do God's will. And for all his efforts, what they wanted to do was to stone him. Okay, I kind of get that. You know, we're terrified. If we get rid of this guy who's forcing us to go in there, we can go back where we feel comfortable. But it ends with what? What shuts up the crowd? The glory of the Lord lights up the temple, or the tent of meeting. And you would think, at least to me, you would think that all of a sudden their focus would be changed back to who really brought them out. It wasn't Moses, it was God. And they knew that. It's a very interesting part of this passage that I find puzzling. You would think, I can agree with some of their terror and see how some of their thought processes was, but when God showed up, you would think they would have changed back to focusing on God, who got them to where they are. But they didn't. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long will this people despise me, and how long will they not believe in me in spite of all the signs that I have done among them? I will strike them with the pestilence and disinherit them, and I will make of you a nation greater and mightier than they." So God's decision was, okay, I've had all I can stand of these people. I'm going to wipe them out. We'll send a pestilence, which they'd already experienced, or at least seen in Egypt. And God was just going to wipe them off the face of the map and start a new covenant with Moses' people. But here's what Moses does. "But Moses said to the Lord, 'Then the Egyptians will hear of it, for you brought up this people in your might from among them, and they will tell the inhabitants of this land, they have heard that you, O Lord, are in the midst of this people. For you, O Lord, are seen face to face, and your cloud stands over them, and you go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now, if you kill this people as one man, then the nations who have heard your fame will say, it is because the Lord was not able to bring this people into the land that he swore to give them, that he has killed them in the wilderness. And now, please, let the power of the Lord be great, as you have promised, saying, the Lord is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, forgiving iniquity and transgression, but he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations. Please, pardon the iniquity of the people according to the greatness of your steadfast love. just as you have forgiven this people from Egypt until now. This wasn't the first time that the children of Israel had rebelled against God. I mean, it didn't take very long for them to start having issues. When Moses went up on the mountain for the Ten Commandments, what did they do? He was only gone a little more than a month. And in that time, what happened? Yeah, they turned pagans. They built a calf as their god. It's an amazing transformation just like that. This would not be the first time that God had pardoned them. What happened when God sent manna from heaven? What did he tell them? Only take what you need. First thing they did was defy that. So they have a history of not following directions. Okay. So does God just write it off and tell them, okay, well, I'm letting you slide again? No. Chapter 14, verse 20. Then God said, I have pardoned according to your word, but truly as I live, and as all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, none of the men who have seen my glory and my signs that I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not obeyed my voice, shall see the land that I swore to give them to their fathers. And none of those who despise me shall see it. But my servant Caleb, because he had a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land into which he went, and his descendants shall possess it. Now, since the Amalekites and Canaanites dwell in the valleys, turn tomorrow and set out for the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall this wicked congregation grumble against me? I have heard the grumblings of the people of Israel, which they grumbled against me, saying, as I live, declares the Lord, what you have said in my hearing I will do to you. Your dead bodies shall fall in the wilderness, and of all your number listed in the census from the 20 years old and upward who have grumbled against me, not one shall come into the land where I swore that I would make you dwell, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. But the little ones who you said would become prey, I will bring in, and they shall know the land that you have rejected. But as for you, your dead bodies shall fall in the wilderness, and your children shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years, and shall suffer for your faithlessness until the last of your body, your dead bodies, lies in the wilderness according to the number of days in which you spied out the land, 40 days, a year for each day. You shall bear your iniquity 40 years, and you shall know my displeasure. I, the Lord, have spoken. Surely this will I do to all this wicked congregation who are gathered against me. In this wilderness they shall come to a full end, and they shall die. 40 days. Have we heard about 40 days before? 40 days and 40 nights? It's an interesting thing. We don't really have the time, but it'd be interesting to figure out how many of those things kind of fit together. back to verse 28. It says that they're going to die in the wilderness, which is exactly what they asked for in verse 2. Interesting. Okay, given the promises that God's made and the amazing things that he'd done in the Exodus from Egypt. How should the Israelites have responded? What should they have done when they came to this land and got the report? Yeah, you would think they would have just gone ahead. What else might they have done besides just trying to stone their leader? Obviously, they should have just gone ahead. What do you think you would have done?
Just ask God's forgiveness for being so hard-headed and doubtful.
Yeah. There's no evidence that they ever decided that, at this point anyway, that they'd made a mistake. Even when the evidence of God in the tent of meeting showed up, they were still fighting against God at this point. So they didn't do things like, well, okay, let's figure out how are we going to do this. Is this possible? God, show us how we're supposed to do this. They didn't ask Moses to go to God and give him that information. They just immediately decided it was impossible, and they wanted to go back, which is something they'd talked about in the past as well. We don't have time to look at that, but they did. So, how did they respond? What is it that they did? Well, we already talked about it. They were terrified. They were fearing their death. In fact, they were fearing it so much they wanted to go back to where they were probably going to be enslaved again. And several times God calls them rebellious people. In our Sunday morning sermons, I think almost everybody at this point has described sin as rebellion to God. So when they were put to the test, the first thing they did was what? They failed. They sinned. What does God say that they did in verse 11? They despised him. That's not questioning his judgment. That's not saying, yeah, I'm scared. That's something totally different. How would you describe that word? What does that word despise mean to you? What's that? Yeah, hated him. It's not distrust or something like that. This is hatred. Yeah, that's right. So God's judgment on them, if we think about it, even though. Let's go back to his original intention before Moses talked to him. He was just going to send a pestilence and have them all die right there. He would certainly have been just to do that. So what else? They wanted to return to captivity. What was one of the things they wanted to do to their leaders? Yeah, they wanted to murder them. Because, why? What's that?
It's their fault.
Yeah, Yeah, it was Moses and Aaron that brought them out of Egypt, so they're the first target, the easy target. God's a little tougher. All right. So what was God's judgment on them? What was it that was going to happen to them? It was several things.
One of them is they're going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years.
40 years. That's a long time. Yeah, they're all going to die. Yeah, they're all going to die in the wilderness. Now, they had come from Egypt, was probably one of the most technically advanced. They had be like going from living in downtown Manhattan to being forced to walk from there to middle of Wyoming. And then now you're going to, all the things that you were barely able to put up with are going to be your way of life for the next 40 years. It's not just walking around for 40 years. This is going to be a very tough life. Okay. So they were going to spend the rest of their life wandering through the wilderness. They were not going to enter the promised land. And if we think about the way that they were living at the time, now God would again, even though he was going to watch them all die, he did continue to take care of them and their little ones. One of the things that is interesting here is that the children, which were, if you're a parent and you have children, the prospect of wandering around in the wilderness until you drop dead is going to be a little terrifying. But God did promise that the children were going to be the ones to go into the promised land. Now, there's a couple of things. If we look at enough commentaries and all of that, there's a couple of things that are interesting here, and we're just going to touch on them because we need to keep moving forward here. But if you were training an army and you needed to toughen them up and make them battle worthy, you probably wouldn't want to do that playing video games and watching TV and those kind of things. You put them out where it's tough, where you got to survive, so that when you go into battle, you know how to do those things. It was a great way of building up a very capable army. Those people, by the time they were able to enter the land, were already battle worthy. They were already hardened people. They had dealt with lots of hardship. So, like Pastor Bob would say, that's free for nothing. Okay. So let's get to our section in Hebrews here, chapter 3, verse 7 through 4:1. It says, "Therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you hear my voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion," which we just talked about, "on the day of testing in the wilderness where your fathers put me to the test and saw my works for 40 years. Therefore, I was provoked with that generation and said, they always go astray in their hearts. They have not known my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest." And that's the subject for tonight. "Take care, brothers, lest there be in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart leading you to fall away from the living God. but exhort one another every day as long as it is called today, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin, for we have come to share in Christ, if indeed we hold our original confidence firm to the end. As it is said, today, if you hear my voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. For who were those who heard and yet rebelled? Was it not those who left Egypt led by Moses, and with whom was he provoked for 40 years? Was it not those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness, and to whom did he swear that he would not enter, that they would not enter his rest, but those who were disobedient? So we see that they were unable to enter because of unbelief. And chapter 4, verse 1. Therefore, while the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us fear lest any of you should seem to have failed to reach it. Okay, the author of Hebrews quotes Psalm 95, which itself is about rebellion of the Israelites against God. According to this quote and Hebrews 3, what was the real problem with the Israelites? Rebellion. And rebellion is? And do we still do that today? Yeah, maybe. Just a little, now and then. Okay, and what happens? What does sin lead to? This is a good example. When the Israelites sinned, they rebelled, sinned, what happens after that? Hardened heart, enmity with God. Yeah. It was different at that point because they were looking ahead, where we have the opportunity to look behind. But it was still faith in God, and they fell away. They had faith, but only to the point where they kept seeing miracles. And as soon as life got tough, they decided that we'll go a different route. So they didn't really have faith. You can see something and believe that you saw something, but that's not really belief. Faith is... describe faith. That's right. That's right. Okay. So, what is the danger to us as Christians if we think about this situation that Israel was in and what Paul's trying to tell us, or what the author of Hebrews is trying to tell us? Sorry about that. Well, yeah. When we come upon a difficult time, and in this country we really haven't had too much difficulty other than, some of us have health issues from time to time, family members that are potentially family members that are not Christians that are involved in terrible things. The horrible death of a loved one. We haven't experienced in this country some of the things that happen in other countries, like Muslim-held countries where Christians are being beheaded. But our reaction should be what? Yeah, obedience. We have we've got several ways we can react to things that are dangerous or tense or just horrible. And one, we can ask God, why are you letting this happen? Or in some cases, a person will have a loved one die and they say, well, there can't be a God. God wouldn't let this happen to my loved one. You know, terrible cancer, great pain and all that stuff. There are people that turn their back on God because of things that happen in their lives. And I don't want to speak for everybody, but don't you think that God brings in trials, tribulations, those kind of things to have us not focus on ourselves, but focus on Him? We heard a little bit about that this morning, and we heard about it last week on the Sunday morning service, that many of the things that we experience is God trying to teach us something about ourselves and about Him. And when we rebel against that, we sin against God. Now, that doesn't mean that every time we do that, we're going to wander for 40 years until we drop dead. But we have an example here that we can follow. And we need to keep moving. I go down too many rabbit trails. What are we urged to do about it when these things happen? What is it that we're urged to do? If we look at chapter 3 in Hebrews, verses 12 and 13 through verse 1 in chapter 4. There's several things that we're urged to do. Yes? What's that mean? Yeah? I think it's bigger than that. Yes. One of the things that we need to do, and again, this morning, he didn't exactly say it this way, but he helped to understand this. We can't help each other, and we can't, as it says in this passage, exhort each other unless we know what each other is going through. It's real easy. Doesn't matter whether you're a pastor or a deacon or a member of the congregation, to know that somebody is having a difficult time with something and say, well, you know, I don't want to bother them. It's, they have enough trouble. They don't need me over there. Which is an easy way to say, I don't know how to deal with this, so I'm just not going to. If this is a church family and you had a family member that was going through those kind of situations and struggling either with health or whatever, or maybe struggling with God, you wouldn't turn your back on it and say, well, I probably shouldn't get involved because maybe I don't have all the answers. You'd want to be in the middle of it. You'd want to do whatever you could to help that family member. If we're truly family members in the church, that's the way we should treat each other. We should know each other. We should know what's going on. It should be an easy thing for somebody to go to another church family member and say, you know, I've got this going on. I really need some help. And just like another family member, we'd respond with, what can I do? Okay. So what's another thing? And this that we talked about this briefly earlier. In your life, has anybody here ever had something happen and get really angry with God about it? Yeah, I think we've all done that. We've all recovered from that, but lots of people don't recover from that. Okay. So I came up with the two things. One is we have to guard against, we'll call that hardening our hearts, blaming God for the things that he's brought into our lives to teach us something, and we get mad at him about it. And the other is to exhort each other, to help each other, to be involved with each other every day. And it's not the work of pastors, it's not the work of deacons, it's the work of everybody. So this rebellious generation of Israel that came out of Egypt missed out on this promised land because they sinned. They decided they all of a sudden hated God and wanted to go back to the way they were before God saved them. Again, that's not unlike today. A lot of people join a church. They are all excited about it, and then eventually they start to fall back and do things that they said they were never going to do again, and maybe what they... I know of this is something that happened to me in high school. I had a friend that I invited to church, and he was all excited, and he was involved, and his mother and his brother, about 3 years younger than him, got killed in a car accident while he was at church. And he just came all undone. It was God's fault that that happened. And about halfway through college, I had stayed in touch with him, and about halfway through college is when he started to, this is probably 6 years, he started to realize that it wasn't God's fault, that there was a bigger picture that he couldn't see. And he ended up going through college and then going to seminary, and I kind of lost track of him, but last I heard, he was a pastor out in Texas. Just because that happens doesn't mean, like Israel, that you're going to be dead to God forever. I think it's important to know that, just in case at some point you have an issue where you're angry at God about something. But the important thing is that when things happen to us, that we need to react totally the opposite of the way the children of Israel reacted. We're going to have trials. We're going to have things happen, and we got to make sure that our focus is on God and not on what it means to us. Okay. So, we have any... Oh, gosh. I'm going to skip over here this one section. I can't. Let me read this. This next section is quite a bit shorter. We're going to read Hebrews 4:1-13. It says, therefore, while the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us fear lest any of you should seem to have failed to reach it. For good news came to us just as to them, but the message they heard did not benefit them because they were not unified by faith with those who listened. For we who have believed enter that rest, as he has said, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Although his works were finished from the foundation of the world, for he has somewhere spoken of the seventh day in this way, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again in this passage said, they shall not enter my rest. Since therefore it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly received the good news failed to enter because of disobedience, again he appointed a certain day, today, saying through David, so long afterward in this word already quoted, today if you hear my voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. So then, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God, for whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works, as God did from his. I'll just stop right there. He's trying to describe God's rest. Was that the land of Canaan? Was that this land flowing with milk and honey? Was the land that Israel was ultimately to move into God's rest? And he's telling us no. Because if it was, why would David, at a much later date, looked forward to that rest in the future? Does that make sense? Okay. So what did, in Genesis, we're told that God rested. What did he rest from? Creation, right. And thinking back to Genesis 1:3, did humanity ever share in God's rest? No? What stopped them? Sin. The fall. Right. We can only speculate on the way things would be today had sin not entered the world. But Adam had a job, and he was doing that job. We don't know what would have happened had they not messed up. But at some point, the earth would have been subdued, and we can only, the God's rest was supposed to be given to man, and we couldn't accept it. So, looking backwards now, we know what that means and what is God's rest. Where do we get God's rest? Yes, and not just when we accept Christ. And even for the Israelites, that rest wasn't going to happen when they moved into the land. It was going to come when they did what? Well, when they came into the presence of God, when they left this earth. This earth has work. We are responsible to do things every day. It's not simple things. I mean, even if you don't have a complicated job, you still have to have some kind of income. You have to take care of yourself somehow. Every minute of every day, there's something that you have to do. Even if that's sleep, so you've got enough energy to do something the next day. So we enter God's rest when we're in the presence of Jesus. That's God's rest. If we look at the passage from the beginning again, it mentions that those people were looking forward to something. We get to look backward at that thing. And that thing was when Jesus came and provided the perfect sacrifice. Now we have a clearer picture of what God's rest is. Unfortunately, I got about 6 pages of notes to go, and we're about 5 minutes over.
We just get till 7:30 when the kids get out.
Yeah. Okay. So the rest is not an earthly rest. It's a heavenly rest. And we get little glimpses of that throughout the New Testament. Yes. Spiritual rest. Ultimately.
So while we cannot experience physically God's rest, the peace that surpasses all understanding is our spiritual rest. No matter what the trial, no matter what the tribulation, no matter how hard the work, we can still find that spiritual rest in our Lord Jesus Christ today.
That's absolutely right. And I know some people here who've had struggles, and they're experiencing that rest. They're experiencing not only that rest, but they're experiencing the help that we give each other and the things that we do to help those people find that comfort in God.